Welcome to episode 103 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. You'll probably have noticed that this week's episode is a little on the late side, and the main reason for this is because I'd received enough mail from people interested in the Hokkaido workshop to make it worthwhile my putting some time into actually planning it out more and seeing if it's really viable. So starting last weekend, I did just that. I planned it all out and I started to put together an itinerary. I always get that wrong. And I made a lot of phone calls and created a new website for the workshop. And if you're at a computer right now, take a look at www.mbpworkshops.com. And I'll put a link in the show notes too, so that if you aren't at a computer, you can check it out later. It's just a simple website though, nothing fancy. I really wanted to just concentrate on getting the information out to you, but that's what it basically does. It gives you all of the information that you'll need, or all that I can foresee you'll need to decide on whether or not you want to join us at this, for the Hokkaido workshop. And if anything's still not clear, having taken a look at the page and listened to this podcast, but you are interested in coming along, please do drop me a line at workshops@martinbaileyphotography.com, or contact me via the forum or with the contact form on the Martin Bailey Photography website. Anyway, this has taken up all of my free time over the last weekend and for the last few evenings, so I wasn't able to prepare a podcast, but I have, I've got a lot of information here, so I figured that it would like kill two birds with one stone if I was to just make this a workshop special and just give you pretty much the information that I've put on the website and more. Just basically I want to give you enough information to help you understand what it's all about. Firstly, I have to tell you that I'm really getting excited about the workshop now that I've started to look into it and do all of the planning. And I'm also really looking forward to meeting you guys, the people that do join us in Hokkaido next year, for what I've started to affectionately call the Winter Wildlife Wonderland Workshop. And it's a bit of a tongue twister, and that's not going to be the official name, so don't worry. But it really does sum up Hokkaido, and Hokkaido is basically situated at the very top of Japan, the northernmost island. Looks a little bit like a diamond shape, sitting at the top of the banana-shaped main island of Japan. And it's not just an incredibly beautiful place, but because of the weather there, the climate, it's also home to some amazing wildlife. And you'll see the majestic Japanese red-crowned crane, stellar sea eagles, white-tailed eagles. That's the main big birds that we'll see. There's also the Ezo deer, and Ezo is just basically a Japanese word for Hokkaido. And a lot of these, the species of animals are specific to Hokkaido, but they often just put the Ezo on there for plants as well, and anything that's really of Hokkaido. And if we're lucky, we'll see some Ezo kitsune, which is the Hokkaido fox. And maybe, I'm still looking into this, but maybe we'll be able to find somewhere that we can go and see some owls as well. So on the itinerary, though, we'll definitely see the first four foxes if we're lucky, and owls if I can figure out how to do that. As the winter is pretty harsh in Hokkaido because of the weather system that sort of drops down from Siberia, and the first place it hits is Hokkaido, there'll be some breathtaking winter landscapes that we'll try to pull in as much as we can as well. For those that have listened to the podcast for a while, you'll know that I'll be able to help you out with all sorts of shooting situations, as well as keeping you busy with shooting ideas and some mini assignments that I'll be planning for the shoots that while we're there. I'll also be making sure that you do know everything that you need to know to keep yourself and your camera going in some pretty harsh weather conditions. I will be on hand the whole time to give advice, ad hoc advice as necessary, and also instructions on how to improve your photography for those that want it. For those that don't, I'm thinking that you maybe will just be able to sort of eavesdrop on the conversation, figure out you already know it, and then go off and enjoy the shooting. But the majority of the time, I'll be handing out snippets of advice, and we'll do some structured instruction as well as we go on. And then, you know, as we do sort of make our way around this winter wonderland, we'll spend a certain amount of time on a bus, and I'll sort of be giving you tips and tuition while we're actually on the bus to make us so that we can use the time as best possible. And that will really be preparing us for the specific location that we're heading towards. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of different ways that I will hand this information out. And really, I think we should save a lot of that for the actual workshop. We will have sessions at the hotel as well, and hold review sessions, of our images as we start to sort of, you know, fill our memory cards up. And, if you bring laptops or viewers, I'm also probably going to be able to take a laptop so that we can use that to actually view and review images taken during the day or during the previous days, and sort of build that into the whole learning experience. So what that will allow us to do, though, is, you know, I find that if you do look, one of the amazing things about digital is that you get the instant feedback. So we'll be able to see what went well and what didn't go so well. And then hopefully, you know, the hints and, you know, the different techniques, things that I sort of start to relay out to the attendees will basically help us to sort of improve our techniques as the workshop progresses. I've spoken to people over the years, many people have said to me that they'd love to come to Japan and shoot here, but have shied away because of the language barrier. And if you're one of these people, then there's no need to worry. But without trying to blow my own trumpet too much, I'm totally fluent in Japanese, both written and spoken, and we'll be able to help out as much or as little as you want. And you might even be able to pick up some Japanese while you're here. So apart from those that have been shying away because of the language barrier, who is this workshop for? Well, really, it's anyone that can stand the cold weather and loves wildlife and nature photography, and anyone that wants to improve their photography while shooting the shots of a lifetime. Note that most of the tutoring will assume a basic level of understanding of photography and of your equipment, but photographers of all skills and levels are very, very welcome. Even if you are an advanced or a professional photographer, you'll definitely benefit from this workshop. And it'll definitely give you the opportunity to take away some new skills and certainly some great photos. I've made some of the keywords on the webpage that I've put together into links, and they'll show you some example shots, the sort of subjects that you'll be able to shoot while we're there. So you can click on these links and just, you know, they're like, some of them are like little mini albums. And once you open the new, you move to the new page to display the larger photo, you'll have the back and forward buttons below the image so that you can sort of click through them. And I've also added a row of thumbnails in the middle of the page to add some visual elements there and to point out to five or six of my favourites from the batch. So where will we go? There is a table with an itinerary in the middle of the page. But to quickly go through the details, we'll meet at around 7 a.m. at Haneda Airport, which is about 30 minutes by train from Tokyo. And obviously, it depends where you get on the train in Tokyo. Haneda Airport is mostly for domestic flights, so you'll actually fly in to a different airport called Narita Airport if you're coming in from another country. You'll need to make your way into Tokyo and then across to Haneda. I believe that there may also be connecting buses as well, but you know, be warned, it's a few hours. So when you start to plan your flights, it's early morning, so unless you can come in on a very early red eye, you'll probably need to come in on the Sunday, which is why I've made it the workshop start from a Monday, because I appreciate that, you know, Japan is a long haul for most people, especially if you're coming from the US. So if you do want to come in on the, you know, it'll give you time to finish your job on the Friday, and then hopefully fly on Saturday, arrive on Sunday, and then you'll be able to spend a night somewhere on the Monday, the Sunday night, and then get up nice and early to come and meet us at Haneda on the Monday morning. And if you want any help with those, with your arrangements, you know, while you are here, then please just let me know and I'll see what I can do. I should be able to point you in the right direction or give you help on booking some hotels and things for the night or a few nights before, depending on how early you come into Japan. If you're already in Japan, then it won't be such a big deal for you. You can probably make it to Haneda in that morning if you're relatively close to Tokyo. But even then, if you live a way off from Tokyo and you want help with anything like that, please do let me know. So we'll fly out from Haneda at, I think, shortly before 9 a.m. And we'll be heading for the Kushiro Airport, and we'll arrive mid-morning. It's only an hour and a half or so's flight. We will then have a chartered bus with a professional driver that will meet us at the exit of the airport. And this is good because you really need someone that knows how to drive on the icy roads, and often in bad weather, very bad conditions that we have in Hokkaido. So it's going to make it much safer and much more comfortable for us to have a professional driver. And unless we sell like two or three times more seats than I'm expecting we're going to do, we'll have two seats each on the bus as well, so that we'll be able to just drop our camera bags down on the seat next to us. Plus we'll have a trunk to keep all of our clothes and cases in as we move around. We won't be staying in the same hotel for any more than one night. You know, we're going to move around the eastern side of Hokkaido quite a lot, as I'll start to explain. But first off, we'll spend about 20 to 30 minutes going from the Kushiro Airport to the Akan International Crane Center. And by the way, if you're, you know, I'm going to include a number of images today, but I'll just call out the number and not go into details on each image. I've spoken about most of them anyway before, but really I just want to concentrate on explaining about the workshop. So one of my favorite crane shots is actually a close-up. I've got lots of them in flight or of them dancing, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to include them. But I did want to just sort of briefly point you at image number 1203, which you'll be able to see now in iTunes or on your iPod if it's an iPod photo. And it's also included in the MP3 files if you listen to those and your player allows you to flick through them. And you can also see them on the MBP Workshops website that I mentioned earlier, or from my podcasts page at martinbaileyphotography.com. When we get into the Akan International Crane Center, we will spend anything up to the whole day. It'll be like two-thirds of a day once we get there, shooting the cranes and trying out some techniques. Before we even get there, I'll have talked to you during the bus trip there through the best ways to meter these high contrast scenes and your camera modes, things like that. And we'll also start to put that into practice straight away once we get into the center. And, you know, it's really just a great place. I've never been there when there's been less than at least a good handful of cranes, and there's usually many more. We won't have to travel far after this to our hotel for the first night, but I'm going to keep open the possibility of leaving the Akan International Crane Center a little bit early and heading for the town in which we'll stay, because that is where the Ito Crane Sanctuary is that I visited last December and did a number of podcasts on. So really, you know, we're going to stay a little bit flexible there, and it will depend on how many cranes there are at the Akan Center. But if there aren't so many, we'll move to the Ito Crane Sanctuary before daybreak. And then when we get there, we'll start to practice some panning shots, and as it starts to get darker, so we get slower shutter speeds. And, you know, and this travel also won't be in vain, as I say, because we're actually planning to stay in the Tsurui village itself. Once we get to the hotel, you'll have a chance to take probably your, or possibly your first bath in one of those large Japanese baths. And then we'll all sort of get together in a large room for dinner, and we can then start to reflect on the day and take a look at some of our images. And then, you know, really, obviously, we'll only be able to do that if you've got the ability to actually get to go through them and choose a few good ones. And also, I'll try and figure out some way, whether it's on a laptop that I'll take, or whether it's allowing us to sort of connect up to a TV or something. But I'll try and find some way so that we can review these images as a group. And then really, we'll, you know, while during dinner, we can continue to talk about those. And then I'll start to discuss what will be in store for the following day. And I'll continue to then inject techniques and, you know, certain amounts of tuition. And that way, you know, really we'll be able to, you know, continue the learning experience throughout the day. And then really we'll, you know, we'll start to improve on our techniques and make this a real learning experience as we go through the workshop and the tour. We can have a few beers and get to know each other better as well. And the thing is, we'll have to try not to overdo it, as we have to be somewhere before dawn the following morning. So on Tuesday the 29th, we'll head over to Otowa Bridge. And if you listen to episodes 71 to 74 of the podcast, you might remember that this means the Sound of Wings Bridge. And this is exactly what we'll be there for, to hear the sound of wings of the Japanese Red Crown cranes, but hopefully not before photographing them in a misty river, looking down onto a misty river as the first light starts to catch the mist. And I don't want to get your hopes up too high here. It has to be minus 15 degrees Celsius or 5 degrees Fahrenheit for the mist to form on the river at dawn. And I've visited this spot a number of times and not yet caught this. I did see photographs from a guy that did catch it the day before I was there last December. A little bit vexing, but you know, that's the thing with photography. You can't control the weather. But we will be there at a time of year when it's very, very likely that that we'll, you know, we'll be putting ourselves in the best possible position to get that look. But I would say that the chances are probably, I don't know, maybe 10, 20, 30%. I really don't know. If we're lucky, we'll get the chance of some great shots there. You can see a shot that I got from the bridge last December without the mist, and that is image number 1253. The cranes actually only gather here when it's cold, because the water, you know, because the water isn't frozen. It's actually warmer for them to stand in a freezing, icy cold water river than it is to stand out on hills and in the open. So if there are no cranes here because it's a little too warm, well, warm, by warm I mean it's not quite as far below freezing as they, you know, as that minus 15 degrees or more. The chances are at this time of year it's probably going to be around that temperature, so minus 15 degrees or 5 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's warmer than that though, and the cranes are not there, we'll head around again to the Ito Crane Sanctuary straight away. We won't, you know, we won't even stop the bus if we can't see the cranes. Well, not long, any longer than it takes to look out of the window or to walk across the road and take a look. But basically, we'd go over to the Ito Crane Sanctuary, which is about 5 minutes down the road. And then we'll try to catch some, as the sun does come up, we'll sort of get set up, and we'll, as the sun starts to hit the cranes and the ground, then hopefully we'll get, you know, as they start to sort of rejoice, I like that word, as the sun starts to hit them, they will probably start to sort of do a little bit of dancing and sort of courtship dances, and hopefully that will be, if it's cold enough, their breath will freeze, so we can get a little bit stereotypical, but you know, it's great to sort of try and catch those. I've only got one or two shots where they've got a little bit of breath showing, but if you get them early enough on a cold morning, then you know, you can get some spectacular shots there. So we'll try and do that before breakfast, and then we'll head back to the hotel. And then after that, we will go back to the sanctuary again and try to catch some more shots of the cranes for the rest of that morning. And that will have given us just over a full day shooting cranes. Now, I know that, you know, we know that wildlife shooting can take a lot of patience, and you really need to spend a lot more time. But to maximize our time while we are there, this will be it for crane shooting. But we'll have learned a few things as well. And we'll have practiced a few different styles of shooting and hopefully bagged a hell of a lot of good shots. After that, in the afternoon, and when we move is really up to us, but once we move from there, we'll go over to the Kusharo Lake, which is where we'll spend the rest of the afternoon, and we'll be photographing whooper swans, or whooper swans. I don't even know how you say this. Whooper, whooper swans, or whooper swans. And I would imagine it's Hooper, actually. okay, let's move on. An example image of that is number 894. The lake will be frozen, of course, at this time of year, but there is a small area where hot springs flow into the lake, and that's what's making the sort of misty effect that you can see in image number 894. This is also the only reason why the swans choose to winter here as opposed to heading much further south to the warmer climes. And again, we'll stay here until it gets well into twilight, and this way we'll be able to get some more panning shots. There are a number of shots of the swans in flight on the mbpworkshops.com site and on my own site. They're both my own sites. What am I talking about? The main site. If you want to see the shots from here, it's very easy to do that in my online gallery. But really, this is just a quick example. And you can also see here how many birds there are. This is just like one area. And these are all at the moment actually waiting to be fed. That's another reason why they winter here, because they actually sell in there's a few huts here and buildings where you can actually get a warm. You can go in and sort of have something to eat and drink and warm yourself up if you start to get too cold. But also they sell feed, like grain, to sell to the swans, to give to the swans. And that's another reason why they hang around here, because they get fed. The following morning, on Wednesday the 30th, it will be another pre-dawn departure as we head to the Bihoro Pass for a winter landscape shoot at sunrise. And you can see an example shot from here in image number 886. Again, it will be cold, so you'll need to be prepared. We'll get to what you'll actually need to bring shortly. After shooting at the Bihoro Pass, we'll head back to the hotel for breakfast, and then we'll start a long drive to Raosu, Rausu. Where we'll photograph the eagles and the deer. And if it's there, we'll also see some of the sea ice flows before sundown. And Naosu is on the southeastern edge of the Shiretoko Peninsula, which is registered as a UNESCO Lateral Heritage Site. Because it's on that side, though, of the peninsula, we won't see a sunset on this day, so even if weather permits, we won't be able to shoot that. But it's possible that there'll be some ice flows, so that will make something to feast our eyes and our digital sensors or film upon. The following morning, though, on the Thursday the 31st, weather permitting, we have another highlight of the workshop, and that will be to head out into the Naosu Harbour on a chartered boat, and we'll photograph the stellar eagles, the stellar sea eagles, and the white-tailed eagles then. And probably also, if weather permitting, we'll see a sunrise from the boat. And this can make for some pretty spectacular shots, because the birds are often flying around over in front of the sun's disc or the area of the sky that is bright as the sun comes up. So lots of different opportunities here. And they also sort of, They sit, they'll actually, what they do is the people on the boat throw like squid heads and, well, squid and fish heads and things out onto the ice. So that attracts the birds. And what they'll do is they'll get a full belly and then they'll just sort of lounge around on the ice. So similar to what we can see in shot number 267 from my 2004 trip, we will get sort of these opportunities where they're actually sitting around as well. Obviously, much easier to shoot than panning around in the sky, but that's really one of the main things that we'll be trying to do as well. And I'll be showing you some techniques on how to shoot these birds, especially as they fly around the boat. And we'll cover the previous night. We'll cover over dinner, those sort of techniques that you want to use while we're out there. But also, I'll be helping you do that on the boat. The eagles that in the shot that I just mentioned are Stellar Sea Eagles. So to see some white-tailed eagles, you can take a look at image number 874. And this was shot at the Akan Crane Center, actually, not from this boat, although there are many white-tailed. There's probably about as many white-tailed eagles as there are Stellar Sea Eagles that we'll see from the boat. And that's a lot, by the way. I'm not talking one or two birds, I'm talking like swarms of them. But this one shot that I just mentioned was shot at the Akan International Crane Center, and I'm including this just because it's one of my favorite shots of the white-tailed eagles. But you will see a lot more of these when we get to Dausa, as I say, they're just going to be swarming around. We have to actually be careful not to try and catch everything because you can sort of get so overwhelmed at flailing your camera around at everything that you fail to get a good shot. So we'll sort of get into that while we're on the boat as well. After that, we'll go back to the hotel for breakfast and then possibly find some eagles and deer in the trees surrounding the town as we start to head out to drive to Utoro on the other side of the peninsula. This is usually just a drive through the mountains, taking about 30 minutes, but in the winter the road is impassable because of the snow, so we have to go around, taking about 3 hours, unfortunately. Here we'll visit a nature center partway up into the mountains and we'll hopefully be able to photograph the Ezo deer in their element, as I did in image number 927. The other attraction in Utoro is that there is a much higher chance of seeing some spectacular sea ice, and I don't mean just like shallow sort of ice that we saw in the eagle shot earlier. I mean like big, not icebergs, but big sea ice that will it makes for some very nice shots. The ice flows make their way here though from Siberia to this point, and the reason why there's less chance of seeing them in Dausa, where we'll be the day before, is that the Shiretoko Peninsula that we're actually on here stops the ice flow from working its way much further south. It does sort of make its way around the tip and goes down as far as Dausa sometimes. I've seen it there. In fact, obviously you've seen a certain amount of it in the last shot, but it doesn't make its way around there as readily as it does to the Utoro side. So, if we get some good ice flows, then that will make for some spectacular shots as well. And the other good thing about Utoro is that we're now on the northwestern coast of the peninsula. So at this time of year, if the weather permits, we'll have a sunset to shoot at the end of the day. So with the beautiful winter landscapes, that could make for some nice shots as well, as long as you still have energy to actually get out and shoot them. By the morning of the last day, Friday, many of you will be ready for a nice lie-in in a warm bed or a futon, which depending on what we on what we get at the hotel, and we'll probably give the bus driver a lie-in too. But depending on the weather and your energy levels, there will be another dawn shoot close to the hotel. You can often find that the deer come down into the town around the dawn, even during the day sometimes, but there's more coming around the town during the dawn. So we may well get some nice shots, even just out, you know, from the back of the hotel's car park and places like that. And because Hokkaido is a very natural place, there's a lot of trees in the surrounding areas, so it'll be easy to get some relatively sort of wild looking images, even within a short distance of the hotel, I would imagine. So we'll do some landscape work after breakfast, again, weather permitting. If the ice flows are there, we'll go out and shoot those before we move on. And possibly, again, some more deer. And if we're lucky, we may see a fox. And then mid-morning, we'll start to work our way over to Mimambetsu, where there is an airport. And that's where we'll, we'll slowly, as we get to move towards there, we'll try to catch some landscape shots as time allows. But then, you know, as we move over towards the Mimambetsu airport, we basically, we're coming towards the end of the workshop. And then in the mid-afternoon, that will be it. We'll take the flight back to Haneda in Tokyo, and we'll go our separate ways. The itinerary is subject to change during the workshop based on weather conditions. And you also need to note that although I'll do my best to keep us on track, there's always a chance in a place like Hokkaido that severe weather conditions could set in, stopping us from doing some of these things. By signing up, I think we've got no choice to say that by signing up, you agree that, you know, I can't do anything about the weather conditions, and if it doesn't go exactly according to plan, I can't really be held responsible. So, that will be something that you agree. So let's get into a little bit about what sort of gear you need to bring. Obviously, for starters, you'll need one SLR body, camera body, and preferably a second SLR, so that you can keep a telephoto on one and a standard zoom on the other, so that you can capture birds far away with the telephoto, but then also quickly grab your second camera with a standard zoom and catch them as they fly close or overhead. High-end digital cameras might work if they're relatively new and have virtually no shutter lag, but otherwise, an SLR is really the way to go. You can be shooting film or digital, it doesn't really matter, but if you have a choice, go for digital. The main reason is not because, although it's a very large reason, is because of the instant feedback, but film can become very brittle in sub-freezing temperatures, and it just can be a pain to handle. So if you if you can shoot digital, make sure that you do, but also that you bring plenty of memory or a laptop or portable storage to back up your shots so that you can format your cards and reuse them. Portable storage is probably the best thing because you'll be shooting a lot, probably a lot more than you normally would. And remember that on a lot of these days we're shooting from dawn right up to sundown. So you're going to shoot a lot. So it'd be good if you make sure that you've got either enough film or enough memory cards to at least last for one day and then back up in the evening. Or as I say, if you do have portable storage, you can back up during the day, and that will sort of keep your memory cards free. I do suggest that you try to make double backups as well, because if you have portable storage, the chances are very slim, but the hard disk could go. And what I usually do is take a second hard drive and I back up to that. Or if you're bringing a laptop or something, then you can back up to those as well. But I realize that most of you that come from overseas will want to keep your weight down. So of course it's up to you, but you just need to make sure that you have enough memory or film to see yourself through the entire 5 days. With regards to lenses, you'll need a telephoto lens, as I mentioned, no shorter than 200mm. I think that you won't be able to have a good time with anything shorter than 200mm, but 300mm or longer is advisable. If you have a 100 to 400mm zoom, that will work great. The 70 to 300s will work good as well. If you have anything longer, a 400, 500 or 600 millimeter lens, bring it. Standard lenses like a 70 to 200 millimeter is perfect for both landscapes and closer wildlife work. And mid-range zooms like the 24 to 105 will also be a useful tool while you're there, a good all-round lens. If your mid-range zoom doesn't go so wide, not really necessary, but a separate wide-angle lens, either a prime or a zoom for landscape work will work as well. And we may have some use for macro lenses, but if weight is an issue, you don't need to beat yourself up too much about leaving it out. You'll need to bring a good sturdy tripod. And it, if possible, if you're buying for the trip, or you have multiple tripods, bring the longest one that you have, and if possible, one that is higher than your own eye level when standing up straight. And I say higher than your eye level because the legs will sink in the snow, and in some conditions it can sink down by a couple of feet. So, the longer your tripod legs, the better. If you can bring both a tripod and a monopod, then a monopod will be useful for shooting from the boat and for panning shots. But again, this isn't critical, and I know that weight's going to be a thing for most of you. What you can do is use your tripod, just extend one of the legs further than the others, and then that will give you a makeshift monopod. So basically, you don't need to bring that, but if you can. Then and if it's not too much of a pain, then do. You'll want to bring a polarizer filter that fits at least your wide angle or your standard focal length lenses. Not so important for the longer lenses, but if you have them, I suggest you bring them. And battery life is greatly diminished in sub-zero temperatures, so bring lots of spare batteries. If you shoot digital, bring at least four batteries. But seriously, I advise you to bring as many as possible. The trick is to keep them warm in your pocket, and then you circulate them. So keep them warm, put them in, they go dead quickly. You put them back in your pocket and they revitalize. But even then, they don't revitalize. You can't do that and get the same number of shots out of them that you normally would. So you have to make sure that you've got plenty of battery life. Even if you shoot film, the chances are that a lot of old film cameras, you change the battery once every few years, or at least like maybe 6 months or so. Even if you're using film, bring at least one, hopefully two spare batteries, because they'll go flat as well. If you do shoot film, bring enough for like 3 weeks shooting. As I say, you're going to shoot a lot. There's going to be a lot to photograph as we sort of move through the workshop. Maybe not as much if we weren't doing any tuition, but still, a place like Hokkaido, you don't go there without coming away with a lot of shots. As I mentioned, the Hokkaido winter is not for the faint-hearted, with temperatures ranging from zero. In the wintertime, it does occasionally go above freezing, but generally, you've got to think that it's going to be zero down to maybe up to 30 degrees, minus 30 degrees Celsius. So that's from 32 degrees to minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit. The minus 30s or 22 degrees Fahrenheit are rare, but not unheard of. The shot that we looked at earlier from the Bihoro Pass, it was minus 20 degrees then. That's Celsius. So what? That's 10 degrees more than. I'm not used to this Fahrenheit thing, but it's. Let's see. If 0 is 32 Fahrenheit, and minus 30 is 22. We're probably talking like minus 5, minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So no, that's really the early morning shoots, though. It once during the day, it'll probably be a little bit warmer in the sort of between 0 and minus 10. But seriously, though, you need to be protected. You want to protect yourself and your equipment from these conditions. For this, you'll need large plastic bags to fit your entire camera bag in, and clips or some sort of tie to keep it airtight. I actually use one of the LowPro camera bags. I won't be using it on this trip because I'll be taking my long lens, but I use one bag that actually has airtight zips. If you have those, that's ideal. You won't need the camera bags, but you'll need to know that your bag is airtight or at least has like the watertight zips. And that way, what that's for is to stop your gear from getting condensation on when you move from the cold into the warm. We have to always make sure that before we get on, you know, into the hotel, you have to put your camera back in the bag and seal it up, or put your camera into a smaller plastic bag and seal it up. So that way, it won't get condensation on when you move into the warm. Also, to protect your camera while shooting, a waterproof cover will work good. They sell them at most big camera stores. But if you don't have that, again, plastic bags, elastic bands will work. But I find that in sub-zero temperatures, it's not going to rain, right? It's going to be snowing, if anything. And just draping a cloth or a towel over the camera and the lens, you know, sort of leaving it short of the hood, will work pretty well because the snow just sort of drops on it. It's not going to, the snow's not going to melt because it's too cold. So then you just sort of shake it off when it builds up. The other thing there, though, is, you know, if you do have the ability to get hold of one, a thermal padded camera cover works really well. And you can actually get them in Japan that have a pocket at the back to put in the charcoal burners, the hand warmers. And that actually keeps your camera a little bit warmer. And it will also, it allows access to the camera. It's got a window so that you can see, through the viewfinder and the digital LCD. But also, you know, it keeps it warm, so that extends your battery life. So, that's another thing to think about. And if you can't get hold of them, but you want one, I think they're something like $30 or so. I can pick some up. I can order a bunch of these for people that are coming over, and then you pay me later or something like that. So, you know, anything like that that you want. The hand warmers as well. If you want me to pick those up before you come over, let me know well in advance, because I'll probably buy the shop out. But let me know well in advance, and I'll try to order those and get them ready for you when you come over here. If you do already own the charcoal burner type hand warmers, don't bring the charcoal with you because it will be confiscated on the plane. Even in your checked luggage, I had mine confiscated on my way back from Hokkaido last year. That obviously tells you that I was a naughty boy and I actually took it with me. But on the way back, I still had it in my pocket when I got to the airport, and I think they saw me sneak it into my checked luggage. So they opened my bag and it was confiscated. Not a big deal, I was on the way back. But next time, I swore to myself that I would send it to the hotel in advance. What I'll do this time is I'll be sending my own to the bus company, and they'll bring it with them. So the hand warmer itself, the burner itself, is fine, but the charcoal can't be taken on the plane because it's combustible. So another thing to think of, if you want me to just stock that for you and send it on, let me know. For yourself, you'll need some good thermal underwear, long johns and thermal shirts, preferably long-sleeved, and one or two pairs of like padded trousers if you can, quilted trousers like the ones that they use for skiing, but not brightly coloured. You know, we don't want any Elvis impersonations. You'll scare the wildlife. So, you know, normal colours, blacks, beige, greens, khakis, those sort of things will be good. You can get these in outdoor stores, and some of them are relatively cheap. If you have waterproofs, like preferably Gore-Tex or something like that, then the trousers and a jacket will be great. And that way, actually, if you do have those, then it really means that you can buy the cheapest padded or quilted trousers that they have, because you can just drop the some Gore-Tex trousers over the top if you have them. I actually, for winter, I use a Gore-Tex down jacket, which means that I don't take a thin Gore-Tex for the, like an over jacket. My down jacket is actually Gore-Tex, so that works well. But you need those layers. You need to be warm, or you can't concentrate on the on your photos. You're gonna have trouble doing this to a certain extent anyway. Especially if we're standing around. But what I generally find is while it's exciting, your blood's rushing and you can keep warm. But without the right clothing, no amount of excitement is going to keep you warm, and it is actually going to be dangerous. So, we don't want any accidents. The best thing to do is make sure that you keep wrapped up and keep warm. You'll need some thermal boots or very, very thick boots with a good sole for walking on snow and ice, or at least some good quality winter hiking boots and some thick warm socks. A hat, preferably one like those bomber hats. I sometimes use one of those. They come down over your ears. Or if you have a down jacket with a hood that comes up and then sort of wraps around the front of your face, that will help to keep the chill off, not only off your head and your ears, but also from your chin, and and from around your neck. And you want a thin pair of thermal gloves, preferably with some rubber grip and or some kind of like non-stick sort of material on the inside of the fingers and the palm, so that you can actually operate your camera with the gloves on. I find that fiddly work like changing compact flashcards, things like that, can be difficult sometimes with thin gloves. But if you can find a pair of thin gloves that allow you to do that much, then you're laughing. That'll be great. You'll then also want either good pockets that you can stick your hands in easily, preferably on a down jacket, or an additional pair of larger gloves, like down gloves, that you can put on. Mittens are good, and put them on over the first pair of gloves, so that will keep your hands warm while we're standing around. You want one or two polar fleeces. Depends how smelly you get, I guess. Surprisingly enough, sometimes you do actually get quite hot with all of the layers, especially when you come onto the bus and you've still got them on. You take them off, but you can get a little bit sweaty sometimes. And if you're like me, that means that you'll start to ming a little bit after a few days. So, two polar fleeces is a good idea if you can bring them. Also, if you can't get fleeces, then some nice woolly jumpers or something like that, or sweaters if you're from the States. But the thing is that you just want to make sure that you've got like your underwear, a good mid layer or two, and then a down jacket or something like that on the top. That will keep you nice and warm and give you enough warmth to allow you to concentrate on your photography. The one or two of the hand warmers, like I say, I usually take two. One, I put in the camera, in the to keep the camera warm. Another one I use in a pocket, or I'll grab it on my hands. But if I'm using two cameras, then I may need both for the cameras. And then I use like the chemical hand warmers, Hokkaido they're called in Japan. I use those sort of things to warm yourself up. Again, if people want these, you can buy them for your feet as well, so that they'll look like the front of the sole of your shoe, and you drop them into your boots, and that will keep your feet warm for like half a day to a day. If people want these, I can source them here and send them on. Let me know, and as long as I know the numbers, I can do that in advance and then just charge you later. Like the camera covers, anything like that that you think that you want, but you don't want to bring with you, or you can't get yourself, let me know and I'll take the orders and I'll work it all out for us. So all important question, the remaining question that I'm sure you all want to know is, how much is this going to cost? Well, it's going to be US dollars 1,950, or in yen 220,000 yen, whichever currency suits you. And this is pretty much all inclusive. So the in the included in the package We have, like I say, almost everything from when we meet at Haneda Airport until we say goodbye at Haneda Airport. So that means that I have included the cost of the domestic flights from Tokyo to Hokkaido and back, all accommodation and meals while we're there, the chartered bus and a professional driver to transport us all over the eastern side of Hokkaido, and there's a modest charge for my tuition fees included in that. And also, I've sort of built in a little bit of cost for some supporting materials that I'll bring along and other administration fees. It also includes the admission fees for the planned facilities and the excursions that we'll do, like the chartered boat and the admission fee to the Akan International Crane Center, things like that. So if, unless you want to buy some, you know, you want extra beer or something in the evenings, or you want to buy souvenirs and things, you wouldn't even actually have to bring any money with you. So that's all inclusive at $1,950 US, or 220,000 Japanese yen. What that does not include is the your travel costs from your home country to Japan, and the cost to get across from the Narita Airport to Haneda Airport. That's about $30 or so. But once you're at Haneda Airport, that's it. If you live in Japan, I know that a few people that have wrote me saying you're interested actually live here in Japan. That's great. Just make your way over to Tokyo. But the cost of that is not included for anyone, including people coming in from out of the country. I tried, but I'm not actually able to take out any travel insurance in Japan for people traveling into Japan from another country. So you will also be responsible for travel insurance. And I suspect that it will be easier for you to just do that for the whole length of your trip. So from when you leave home for your flight into Japan and everything, just cover yourself for the whole thing. And note that I also can't take out any insurance, not just travel insurance for yourself in case you get sick and things like that, but for your equipment. So really, all kinds of insurance, you're responsible for that yourself. Note that I cannot also take out insurance for me as the operator of this tour in case, say, you fall off the side of a frosty mountain. The conditions are very harsh, and by signing up, you're agreeing to a certain amount to partake in something very similar to an extreme adventure holiday. So, if it's like, I don't know how this works, but if you want to jump off the side, if you want to start doing base jumping or something like that, no one's going to insure you. But, it's not quite that bad. But with me at the moment, I cannot take out insurance to cover me as an operator. So you are also going to be basically agreeing by signing up that you won't hold me responsible if you can't listen to instructions and you end up with frostbite. I will help as much as I can, but at the end of the day, there are things that are out of my control. These are the things that are not included. Your insurance for your equipment as well. I actually take out insurance on all of my equipment for domestic and international travel for certain pieces of equipment. So no matter where I take my equipment, I'm covered like internationally. If you don't have that sort of thing, you can probably tag it onto your travel insurance, but make sure that you have enough money to cover the whole amount that your equipment would cost to replace. Now, Japan is a safe country, but there's always a risk that someone could break into the hotel room while we're at dinner. If you don't take your equipment down to the dinner hall with you, then that's a risk we take. But I usually find that, I've been on these tours before. I've never heard of anything going wrong, but that doesn't mean that it won't. So, please do, if you're worried about this in the slightest and you're not prepared to shoulder the risk yourself, cover yourself with insurance before you leave your own country until you get back. The other thing that isn't included is, like I mentioned earlier, if you want a few more beers, what I'll probably do is we'll have a few bottles of beer that come out with the evening meals, but I've budgeted for a certain amount. If you want more than that, or you want other stuff, say you want a bottle of whiskey or something to really try to mess up your pre-dawn rising for the photography. If you want more than comes out in the normal sort of budget, then you'll need to pay for that yourself. Also, there may be, say, weather conditions stop us from doing certain things. We may decide to go to other places. If, for instance, we couldn't go on the boat, that would free up some budget, so I would shoulder that, obviously. But if, say, we went on the boat and then we all decided that we want to go somewhere else, and that costs more money. If it's a lot of money, then I won't be able to cover it. If it's a little bit, I'll probably be able to. So there's just these sort of things as well. But apart from that, it's pretty much all in. As I say, the bus, the hotels, the domestic flights, everything, meals, it's all included in the prices that I quoted a moment ago. So, what do you do next if you're still interested? What I'm going to do, I've not put them in place yet, but in the next, probably tomorrow, but probably by the time most of you listen to this, I will place a button on the mbpworkshops.com page at the bottom there, that will basically be a payment button for you to pay either with a PayPal account or with a credit card. It's the same place, but if you don't want to create an account or you don't already have a PayPal account, then you will you can actually just use a credit card and pay right there. I'll put one button for dollars and one button for yen. The thing is here, I'm going to give as an incentive for you to book early so that I know how many people really want to come. As an incentive, I'm going to include an early bird discount of $100 or 10,000 yen. So if you book before October the 15th, then you will get the well, you'll get this workshop for US$1,850 or 210,000 Japanese yen. So that's like I say, $100 or 10,000 yen less than the amount that I just quoted a few moments ago. After October the 15th, I will continue to take bookings until the places are filled or until it's too late for us to actually get into the hotels and things. And when that happens, I'll state that on the page. I'll put a sold out sticker up there or something. But I really urge you to book as early as you can to avoid disappointment. The like I say, the what after October the 15th, the price will go back to the original price that I quoted earlier. So if you want to sort of cash in on the early bird discount, get the workshop for $1,850 or 210,000 yen, booked before October the 15th, 2007. So like I say, the buttons aren't there yet, but they will be within the next 24 to 48 hours. I'll probably get it done tomorrow. If you're interested but you still have outstanding questions or queries, please don't hesitate to contact me with the Contact Us button on the website or on the main site at martinbaileyphotography.com, or just mail me on workshops@martinbaileyphotography.com. If you do use one of the web forms, please double check your mail address in the form, because if it's not valid, I obviously won't be able to get back to you. You will also be CC'd in the email that you send me from the Contact Us form. So if you don't see a copy of the mail, that means that you got something wrong in your address. So do it again. Either way, if you don't hear back from me within 48 hours, please mail again. It's possible that that it got lost. Very unlikely, but please do mail again if you don't hear back within 48 hours. And that's about it. That's pretty long. We're going to go over an hour here, but there was a lot to tell you, and I hope that it's been worth your while. And I guess the only thing that remains to say is that I look forward to seeing you in Hokkaido for the Winter Wildlife Workshop of a Lifetime. So that's it for today. Hopefully, even if you aren't planning on joining us, it was good to hear what we'll be getting up to next January. I really do urge you to consider coming though, and if you do want to go, try to get your booking in before October the 15th to get that early bird discount. You know, sure, it's not cheap, but when you consider all of the things that we'll be doing and the cost of the flights, chartering buses, hotels, meals and everything, I think that you'll be able to appreciate that it's really not that that expensive. And as I say, there's only a very small, modest sort of tuition fee in there for me as well. But I'll definitely be making it a very, very worthwhile trip for you, from both a photography, you know, what you'll take away perspective, and from the learning aspect. You're definitely going to learn a lot while you're there. And like I say, I really just can't wait to see you over there. If you would like to join the workshop to brush up on your photography and meet new friends, but my workshop doesn't quite fit your bill or your budget, then you might also want to consider a few of the other Photocast Network members' workshops that are also being planned at the moment. Namely, John Arnold is currently taking bookings for his photo walkthrough workshop. That's going to be held in the UK at the Crewe Hall, which is a wonderful old stately home. The workshop is being co-hosted by Chris Marquardt of the Tips from the Top Floor podcast, and the course will cover elements of composition, lighting, post-processing and printing. And the cost includes nights in the hotel, as well as bed and breakfast and evening meal in their award-winning bistro. All the details are available at www.photowalkthrough.com/workshop, and there's an early booking discount for this too of £50 for those that sign up before the end of December. Chris Marquardt is holding his four workshops in the US titled Learning to See, each being 4 days and extending over a weekend, so people won't have to take off more time than necessary. The workshops will start on September the 22nd in Colorado and then cover California, Minnesota and Florida throughout the month of October. The course will be highly interactive, focusing on image composition and the general topic of seeing a picture before you take it. And as with the Tips from the Top Floor podcast, everyone is welcome, no matter if it's like with an entry-level point-and-shoot camera or a fancy digital SLR. So with that, you know, it really has turned out to be a photography workshop special. Again, I hope you found it useful, and I really do urge you to get involved in one of these. And you'll be amazed just how much you grow as a photographer having taken some professional tuition like this. So thanks for listening, and you have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.
PhotocastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotocastNetwork.com.